We know that no one can succeed alone. Since the Second World War, more than 120,000 Norwegian women and men have served shoulder to shoulder with friends and allied forces. They have participated in almost 100 missions, fighting for values on which we build our societies. A bridge of trust has been built between our brothers in arms and our allied countries. Some soldiers did not make it home, and many suffered injuries. A few have been honored as war heroes. None should be forgotten.
Welcome to another episode in Friends and Allies, provided by Et Øyeblikk and Evighet. And this project is about letting people know about the cooperation between the Norwegian soldiers and our friends and allies around the world. And today I have taken a trip down to Netherlands. And this story we're going to listen to now is very interactive with one particular Norwegian soldier that we are going to come back to. With me today I have Wilco de Waard. Welcome to you, sir.
Hi, nice to be here.
You fly an Apache helicopter.
That's correct, yes.
That's your work.
That's my work. Actually, I just came from the simulator for training, so yeah.
Yeah, the education never stops.
No, that never stops. 47 years old and still learning.
Did you always wanted to fly a helicopter?
A helicopter, maybe not. I wanted to fly ever since I was able to walk, pretty much, led by movies like Top Gun and Iron Eagle. So the first things came to mind was fighter jets, but then it shifted to rotary wing.
Did you have any connection to the military before you entered service?
My uncle, he was in the army infantry, and I talked a lot with him about being in the MOD, like in the army, and connected that with the Air Force later on.
And then you enter service, and did you went straight away to the helicopter arena, or did you have to walk a longer way?
It was a little bit longer way. I was at I finished high school. Went through the tests for to become a pilot in the Air Force. First, I failed, so that was a bummer. After half a day, so I went back. Had to do something else. Went to school again for a year and decided that's not for me. Not the school, but not that life. So I joined the army first at the Royal Military Academy here in Breda, where we are right now. And during that time frame, after about 2 years, I got a letter in my mailbox that I could do the tests again for the Air Force. And I decided to do the tests again. And then I didn't fail. So on the military academy, I switched from army to Air Force again. So that was the beginning of my story.
And did you choose the helicopter line, or did you go for the big prize for the jets?
No, first of all, it's just to become a pilot. So after the military academy, you go to the military flight school, and over there they decide based on your character, on your results, and on your motivational letter that we had to write where you went to for training in the U.S. and during the military academy and flight school, I decided not to go for jets and put the helicopter, the Apache, in the first place. And that's what I got.
And can you just walk us through what is an Apache helicopter?
The Apache helicopter is our main attack helicopter. It is a armed helicopter with a tandem seat cockpit. So pilots are sitting behind each other, having their own cockpits. And it's a armed helicopter, obviously. Carrying laser-guided missiles, laser-guided rockets, unguided rockets, and 30-millimeter gun below the aircraft. Yeah, and it's a proven concept in many deployments.
And it's a sort of the big hammer.
Yeah, it's not only the eye in the sky; it's also, as you say, the hammer from the sky when necessary. Yes.
You were deployed to Afghanistan.
Yes.
That was your first trip abroad.
Yeah, the first trip, I was actually only 1 year operating as an operational pilot at the squadron at that time. And then in 2004, we left for my first deployment to Afghanistan, to Kabul.
We are coming into a rather particular story now regarding one of our soldiers, Espen Haugland, who was at the time, his platoon was hunting down suicide bombers basically. They were trying to track and stop a suicide bomber who was doing a lot of harm in Kabul and attacking civilians and everybody.
Yeah.
And for Espen's part, he and his colleagues had been following this particular guy for some time, and they got intel that he was about to set up a bomb in the marketplace with hundreds of people. And I reckon that was the intel you got as well.
Yes.
And during the chase, they had a visual on the suspect. He was moving into the square, and they knew he had a bomb. And Espen told me that they had agreed on if he started to move or do something funny, they would shoot him. But he didn't. They actually managed to get on top of him.
Yeah.
And they apprehended him. But then things started to evolve very much. And you were at that point engaged in this operation.
Yeah, the intel, we got the same intel, and we decided, although it was a very bad weather day at the moment, we decided due to the threat to the civilian people in Kabul and military around it, that we were going to try and get airborne with two Apaches from Kabul airport at that time. And the mission was pretty much like in the movie, followed the car with the Black Cross on the roof through the whole city, but due to that weather at that time, we had to fly low level pretty much all of the time. It was and that makes it very hard to follow a car in a city. And coming to the point that where Espen was able to arrest that person, things changed on the ground.
It did, because what happened was the arrest wasn't necessarily very calm. The suspect did resist. He was actually ending up in a hand fight with Espen, and he was of course concerned that he will set off the bomb.
Yeah.
He had a bag with the bomb carrying it, and he was ended up sitting on the suspect, trying to get the bomb as far as possible away from them without tossing it into the crowd, because it was like, he told me, hundreds and hundreds of people at the scene.
Yeah.
And now it turned a bit awkward, because the Afghans, they only saw a foreign soldier beating up one of their own.
Yeah.
So they were starting to move in to help the suicide bomber. And Espen told me he was certain that he was going to be lynched at the time. He was very afraid. And then, as he said, an angel from above descended, and that was you.
I can still see that picture in front of me and how that evolved. I think it was a Mercedes Mike Bravo, the Norwegian military vehicle, standing there in the middle of the square with Espen just fighting and in my mind, like rolling on the floor with that guy. And then all of a sudden, hundreds of Afghans on that marketplace just started to move into that position. Like you say, okay, that's one of us, and whatever happens next, that's not something we like to see. And we decided to do the how we call it, the show of force first. Like we cannot shoot immediately. We won't shoot immediately, especially not unarmed people. But the thing we could do at that moment was show that we were there. And the next thing we could do, at least in the minds of those people, was maybe getting more aggressive to get the Norwegian colleagues out of that situation. So we did.
So how did you do that?
Yeah, first of all, we have very good cameras on our aircraft. So we were able to see the whole thing evolve on the marketplace. And working with two Apaches, one of us just scans around the area and make sure that everything is safe coming into that area where, in this case, Espen was acting. And the other Apache was straight that on that event that was happening in the marketplace. So we could actually see everything that was happening with a vehicle and with Espen and with the people or the person got arrested. And yeah, said the other Apache saw that everyone was moving in. And that's the moment we decided, okay, we need to do something. We need to show ourselves and get out of that big circle around it and get in and fly low level, even more low level than we already were, which is not the best place to be in Afghanistan. But we we managed to do that, and we succeeded to get the people out of that area, and they moved back.
How low is too low?
Nothing is too low when it's necessary, but this was very low, and it's like a treetop level, so to say, and we have to take into consideration that there's not only adults, there's also children, and there's tents and stuff. So, but still, it was a big marketplace, so we were able to maneuver like overhead and show them, and everyone was able to see us, so there was no doubt.
Yeah, because you are actually a big fan coming down.
Yeah, it's a big fan with, and they know Apaches. The Afghan people, they knew Apaches. We were flying there. It was our first deployment, but flying from Kabul, they've seen us flying every day in and out of Kabul city airport. So, and they knew what we could do. Pretty much everyone saw what happened in the Gulf War before that. So there were Apaches involved as well. So everyone knew what Apaches could do.
Were you ever concerned that somebody might open fire on you? Because a lot of people are carrying arms, or was carrying arms.
There's a lot of people asking those questions. But when you're in the aircraft, actually, you're all about procedures. Even this show of force is built on procedures. One aircraft flying low level, the other aircraft is guarding the aircraft flying low. We're in radio communication with our liaison at a warehouse. At that point, it was one of the bases close to that event. So you're working those procedures, and actually you're trusting on the aircraft as well. It's built for the fight, and yeah, it builds a lot of trust.
I have to also say that after this incident, after this operation, Espen Haugland was awarded the highest military award in Norway, the Krigskorset med sverd, the War Cross with sword. And he asked me to express his gratitude for you guys for getting him out of that sort of a pickle he was in.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. And at that time, we didn't even notice all the details, and it's great to hear, and even talk to my to the rest of the crew, especially the ones that are still close in close vicinity, and they were surprised as well, not positively surprised by it, and it's great that to be a part of that and helping him out, and we really appreciate his thanks to us, but especially we as Apache pilots, and I think all rotary wing pilots, we have so much respect for all the people on the ground doing that stuff. So yeah, really deserves it.
You told me that you were the only one left of the crew who still are operative.
Yeah,
and you also told us you are on a training scene. How is your vision of the near future in your business? I mean, we are living in very turmoil time in the world.
Yeah, as everyone knows, and I think it's all defenses we're building on modernizing our forces. There's a big threat. There are more threats. There's multiple threats in the world. It's not only the big thing now in the East with Russia. There's the Pacific. There's all the small turmoil, the relatively small turmoil still in the areas we were deployed to all those years, Afghanistan, Iraq, in Africa, multiple places. So there's a lot going on. The only thing we need to do is be ready to defend not only our own country, our own people, but also NATO and its allies, whoever and wherever. And that's why we modernize our air fleet. And that's what I'm training for right now for the new Apache.
You mentioned our allies, NATO. What's your impression of let's see, the Norwegian forces, who's been an ally to you or to the Netherlands for several decades?
It's great to work with them. It's the first country we met and worked with. And also we had a very severe event with in Kabul as well. One of the first events I can remember being in my first deployment in Afghanistan was that one of the Norwegians got killed by an RPG. Still very fresh in my memory. That was my first thing. And ever since, my bond with the Norwegians over there and the bond with from my colleagues with them as well, and working with them in that area, yeah, that was great. It created an even bigger bond than already is there. And in the Air Force, there's a lot of cooperation with the Norwegians, not only with the rotary wing, but also with the fixed wing.
I have to ask you, do you have a particular moment that will last you for an eternity that you ever involved in any of your deployments?
Ooh, that's a difficult question. There's several moments of joy being there at the rescue. This is one of them that we're discussing right now. After 20 years, it pops up, but I can remember those images very clearly. But there's many more of those which we came back and we were able to assist our troops, Dutch troops or Allied troops on the ground, which gives an enormous good feeling being able to do that. But then there's also the moments that are clearly in my mind about losing colleagues, especially the colleagues on the ground, where we were not able to assist because we weren't there yet, or just being not being able to assist due to the distance or whatever. But yeah, that it goes both ways. A lot of big moments to look back at, but negative and positive.
It's always easy to forget that. When the soldiers are out doing their job, there's always somebody left at home. And what do you think about that?
That is so important to have those people at home supporting you when you're out there deployed. It can go every kind of way. There's colleagues and even myself as well, where the family, it's the first time for families as well. When you get deployed, you know what you're going to do. You're with colleagues. You can discuss everything every single day. You do your work. But being at home, feeling powerless, waiting for a call, if the call comes, not planned, because you're never going to plan a call home because you never know if you're on a mission or not. And then they get worried. So there's a lot going on at home. And the support they have, the patience they have for everything that we do, and waiting to talk to us about how it's going, that also strengthens us being there as a military operating in a deployment. Without that support, I think, yeah, things go terribly wrong in our heads, and then you lose focus, or at least you're, that could happen. So yeah, that support is immense. Yeah, for that, this is a great opportunity to thank all my family as well. And I did that multiple times because I've been deployed multiple times as well. So they had to go through that multiple times, but seeing that with colleagues as well. And it's not always going well, but then there's a lot of support as well at the home front to the families where that's happening. And we support our colleagues at the deployment. So yeah. One big team.
So I was thinking, you just told me you've been deployed several times, multiple times actually, yeah. That was your words. How does this affect you? I mean, do you have any stress reactions, or do you need to relieve some of the thoughts inside?
Yeah, that's the first thing we do, and I told you about the that event in Kabul. It's a lot of procedures we work with, so it's very much different from what the army guys and everyone else working on the ground experience. Whenever something happens, or we have a very difficult mission, or people die on the ground, which I told you about as well, we discuss that. When we get back, we talk about it within the crew, within the flight, within our team, and also with the people that are involved directly, if possible, if they're in the same encampment, for instance. So that's the first layer of just talking it like off out of your mind. But still, there's memories of things that happen. The thing we always do before we get home from a deployment is pause somewhere else in a spot where we are guided by specialists. And that might be Crete in Greece, for instance, or somewhere else. Just a pause. So we leave, Afghanistan, we fly to Greece. We have like 2 days where we talk with people and we do fun stuff and just, yeah, waggle our wings before we head back to our home. So it's not like the big shock coming from Afghanistan all the way back to the Netherlands in this case and be there. That helps. And then, you should be able and it helps to talk. But the difficult thing is, although there's a lot of support, the family and friends, they will never actually really understand what happened. So what I always did is try to understand that as their position as well, but still talk about it. Yeah, and that helps. But so far so good for me. And hopefully everyone that has that challenge, they get the help they deserve.
Thank you very much, and thank you for sharing your story with us, Wilco. It was very nice to hear.
Yeah, you're welcome, and a big thank you for Espen as well for his work, what he did, especially in this this mission.
In Friends and Allies, we hear the stories of some of our closest supporters, reliving with them some of their most intense moments. Et øyeblikk, en evighet.